101.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. Schizophrenia is a chronic, severe, and disabling brain disorder which can cause agitation, hallucinations, and delusions. Because we still don't know what causes schizophrenia, antipsychotic medications and psychological treatments are used to help ease the symptoms of the disease. Today, we explore schizophrenia and one treatment being used to help patients lead a more normal life, cognitive enhancement therapy. Joining me to talk about schizophrenia, our Chief Medical Officer for Greater Cincinnati Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Tracy Scale, Executive Director of PLAN of Southwest Ohio, Dr. Stacy Martz, and Executive Director of the Center for Cognition and Recovery, Ray Gonzalez. He's joining us on the phone. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. Or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi.
Certainly glad to have you all. Great. Glad to have you all here today. I want to start out just defining what schizophrenia is. It's one of those terms people hear on TV, or people maybe use it in casual conversation, not really meaning the true meaning of schizophrenia. So what is it? And Dr. Scale, we'll start with you.
I'm so glad to have the opportunity to clarify that, because there are a lot of misconceptions of what schizophrenia is. Schizophrenia is a disorder of thought. So that's different than a disorder of mood, which is depression, bipolar disorder. Although both of those illnesses can also have psychotic features associated with them. In fact, about 37% of people with bipolar disorder will at one point or another have psychotic features. But schizophrenia is a disorder of thought. It's a neurobiological illness. The organ that's affected is your brain, as opposed to someone with diabetes having your pancreas affected, or if you have heart disease, you know, obviously your cardiovascular system. So in that way, we're trying to also destigmatize this illness. It's not because you had poor parenting that was thought of maybe years ago with the schizophrenogenic mother they used to talk about. We certainly know that's not the case. It's also not necessarily just a brain illness, too. There's a systemic component to this illness. But 1% of the population is affected with this illness, and that's stood the test of time. It's we see it globally. It can affect it typically manifests in the late teens, early 20s. And by that, it really can rob you of very important periods of your lives, the times when you're developing relationships, going off to college, getting into jobs, etc. So when it strikes at that age, sometimes there's a lot of loss associated with that. We try to intervene as early as we can. Some of the symptoms that we see associated with this could be what they call the positive symptoms. It's not necessarily a good thing. It just means they're expressed symptoms, such as the hallucinations and delusions that you talked about. We can go into more detail about that later. Disorganization could be a piece of that. And then there's the negative symptoms, which, again, not a judgment. It's just withdrawn symptoms. So some of the negative symptoms are poverty of content. They don't – people will talk to you and maybe not have a whole lot to say. Doesn't mean they're not intelligent. It means they're not saying a lot. A lot of monosyllabic yes-no answers. Flat affect, not a lot of facial expression, not a lot of motivation to take care of daily activities, even things like hygiene. And these the important part about this illness is very treatable to a certain extent. Some people can do extremely well. Some people struggle more, just like with other illnesses that we see.
Dr. Martz, anything you want to add to that?
No, it's a great overview. And I think when we talk in terms of positive and negative symptoms, the rehabilitation that we're about to talk about, cognitive enhancement therapy or CET, really is one of those programs that addresses the negative symptoms, the things that are not as closely, maybe generically associated with schizophrenia. Things like lacking motivation, impoverishment in thought and verbalizations, and then some of the neurocognitive things, too, that can happen. People with schizophrenia generally and typically have poor short-term memories. They find it hard to pay attention to tasks and concentrate, which if you think about somebody who's having auditory hallucinations, no wonder they have trouble paying attention because they've got a lot going on internally. They also have difficulty with thinking speed. Sometimes people think too fast and they have racing thoughts. More typically for people with schizophrenia, they have slowed thinking speed, part of the illness and also a side effect of some of the medications that they take too. So when we're talking about our cognitive enhancement therapy or CET program, we're talking about addressing those negative symptoms, whereas Dr. Scale will be addressing a lot of the positive symptoms through the medication kinds of regimens that she prescribes for people.
Ray?
Yeah, I agree with both of the doctors there. I would also include that there's a lot of variability in how schizophrenia gets expressed in people. You used to think that there's like this one diagnosis of schizophrenia, but there's lots of different variations of that. Some people can have one or two episodes and never have another episode. Some people are very chronically ill for long periods of time. And that's really where the focus of our CET program is, helping people who are chronically ill to recover significantly. And the other thing I want to bring up is that recovery is the norm. It doesn't mean people will be able to go through life without medication, but they'll be able to come back to close to what they had before the illness occurred. And CET really helps people to gain that capacity to understand how society functions, how the workplace functions, so individuals in recovery from these illnesses can lead very productive lives, very socially integrated lives, and take better care of themselves.
Let's start from the beginning. What are something the signs? Maybe you notice something in a family member or in yourself. What are the signs that you will notice of schizophrenia that you think, gosh, maybe I or my family member should be treated or tested for this?
Drastic changes in behavior, and this gets tricky because, as we said, this often manifests in adolescent years, but you have to make sure, are drugs involved? Because certain drugs can mimic the signs of schizophrenia. But changes in normal activities, particularly attention to personal hygiene and things like that. The person that's usually very well-maintained all of a sudden stops showering, not caring about how they dress, being really or in social, different social cues. And I think Stacey and Ray, you'll agree with this. Normally, maybe the more popular person and talkative all of a sudden becomes more withdrawn, doesn't interact with friends, stops going to class. And I've seen this with many of my younger patients that families will say, he was in college and everything was going fine, and then he just stopped going to classes and he came home and now he sits in his room all day long and kind of stares at the ceiling. Stacey, what do you think?
Definitely. I've heard those stories before. I think you can call it a drastic change in behavior. And if you can't explain it,
does it come on suddenly?
It truly can. Yes.
And like Ray said, everybody's so unique. Right, Ray? Everybody's so unique. So it can be sudden or it could be much more insidious, too. You start seeing gradual signs and slippage into a worsening state. Or you might start seeing someone being paranoid. One of my parents told me that one of her first clues is her son started listening. He was listening at a doorknob all the time. And when she further asked, he was starting to hear things coming out of the doorknob.
Right. And the research shows that people tend to have these strange thoughts, hearing voices or just not being able to think clearly, maybe a year or 2 years before, the family members notices or that they go actually to see a physician to get treatment. On the other side of this is you also have people who get very flamboyant, almost become in a manic state, who get very expansive and think that they can rule the world. Or I had one client who thought he could put on this really great rock and roll concert and get everybody invited, the Beatles, everybody to do this. And he was very energized for a long time until he, became very clear that he really had some psychotic process going on.
We have a question from Josh who wrote in on Facebook. He said, what is the youngest age someone can be diagnosed with schizophrenia?
That's a fantastic question because before we didn't see it for, till late teens, early 20s. That's when we were tuned in to be looking. But I can tell you, I treat someone who was diagnosed at 3. Someone might say that's very odd, but this person was both of her biological parents had schizophrenia. She was actually conceived in a state psychiatric hospital. And her adoptive parents said that from the time she was a small child, and they had older children to compare to, she was sticking things in her ears. She was actually responding to internal stimuli, and it wasn't some little imaginary friend. It was definitely more than that. And this particular young woman was actually treated at the National Institute of Mental Health and started on psychotropic drugs at a very early age. Now in her late 20s and doing much better. But so you can be diagnosed earlier if someone's picking up the cues, and we're starting to hear more and more about that.
Well, you mentioned something interesting there in terms of both of her parents were schizophrenics. What is the genetic connection to this disease?
There is high genetic transmissibility with this illness, but that's not to say, though, that if you have both parents schizophrenic that you absolutely will have schizophrenia. That's not the case. In fact, bipolar disorders actually has a higher genetic transmissibility than schizophrenia.
What causes schizophrenia? Does anyone know?
Unfortunately, we don't know. We wish we knew. And that's another reason why I think sometimes people still think psychiatry in this world we live in here is kind of magical and voodoo and witchcraft and all that, because we don't have a blood test yet that can say, yes, you have schizophrenia and I can show you on this blood test or this brain scan yet. We do know that people with schizophrenia do have different areas of their brain that is adversely affected. Often the frontal, parietal, and temporal lobes of the brain over periods of time, particularly untreated schizophrenia, often have diminished gray area and increased size of lateral ventricle, which is where your cerebral spinal fluid is. I have those brain charts in my office, and even patients with not high cognition can understand that you don't want less of the good stuff and more of the space in your brain.
Stacey?
Yeah, it's very clear with the fMRIs, the research you can do brain scans is very clearly that people who have schizophrenia, you can look up on these brain scans and see the difference between people who are chronically normal, who don't have these illnesses, and see the comparison, especially over time as illness progresses. But it doesn't necessarily mean that someone who has this illness is going to end up in a hospital for the rest of their lives. Now, that used to be the case. It's definitely not the case now that people can recover at significant levels of functioning and hold down jobs, have social relationships, that sort of stuff. It's not easy, but it definitely can happen.
Is there a greater occurrence in men versus women, women versus men?
The literature tends to say there's more men than women, but we don't know if it's manifest more in men. They do say that women tend to have a later onset. And because of that, some of our women, and I look at our own, we have about 6,000 adults with major mental illness at GCB. My personal caseload is about 650 people. And most of my patients have schizophrenia or severe bipolar disorder. And actually, a lot of the women did develop illness later, and because of that, they formed some relationships, had more college education and things. Some of my men that manifested earlier didn't have as many of those assets.
Well, say you are in college and you know, in the dorms, and you maybe start to notice something with a dorm mate or someone that lives on your floor or something like that. What should you do? Do you approach the person? Do you go somewhere else? What do you do?
I think that's an excellent question, too. And I think that, I mean, I'm not well schooled on what's going on most college campuses in terms of mental health treatment, but it's a far cry from when I was in school in the 80s, that there are plenty of resources that you can access on most college campuses that can help you address a problem with a roommate or a friend or even yourself in terms of mental health treatment.
This is
I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago in New York City, and there was a poster for some folks in Rutgers, and they actually have a whole program for people who have been diagnosed to come recommend that they have a major mental illness, and they really work hard to keep those people engaged in school and to make their university experience a successful one. So people can do this. You know, oftentimes people with a mental illness are, you know, intelligent, and if given the right sort of support, they can become very successful.
We're going to continue our discussion about schizophrenia in just a moment. You can call us with your questions or comments, 513-419-7100, or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking this afternoon about schizophrenia. My guests today are Chief Medical Officer for Greater Cincinnati Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Tracy Scale, Executive Director of PLAN of Southwest Ohio, Dr. Stacey Martz, and Executive Director of the Center for Cognition and Recovery, Ray Gonzalez. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We were talking before the break about what people can do if they notice perhaps in a college roommate or a friend that there's perhaps an issue of schizophrenia or something to that effect going on. One of the things we don't hear about as much, though, is how do you notice it in yourself? Is that something that's commonly able to be diagnosed that way?
Wonderful question, because one of the big problems of some people have with schizophrenia is they do not recognize that they have the illness. And Stacey, I think you were pointing out that sometimes they are the last person to know. People around them say something's not right, or they recognize paranoia or delusional material, but the patient or the person themselves doesn't recognize that. And there's a word for that. It's called anosognosia. So it's lack of insight. And it's not unique to schizophrenia, but many people with schizophrenia have it. The people that have anosognosia tend to not do as well. Part of that is because they don't engage in treatment, probably won't take medications. I'm the physician for one of the ACT teams, which is a sort of community treatment team. And many people on that team were in and out of the hospital multiple times. And part of what's going on there is they're on medications for a while. They stop taking medications. And again, Ray, as you were saying, not everybody needs medications. Not everybody responds. But people that are responding to medications and then go off because they say, I don't have any kind of mental illness. Why am I taking this? Things fall apart, get worse. They might get evicted, get in jail. All kinds of things happen. And then they end up back in the hospital. They might be on forced medications because they can be proved that this person's a danger to themselves or others. They're okay again. They get out of the hospital. The same pattern repeats. We do a lot of what I call gentle insight building. And when I feel the person might be ready for that, I say things like, would you consider that maybe I do one of those, like, and try, cause you want to kind of gently challenge the delusion. Family members will often say, come on, that's not true. You know that the FBI has not implanted a chip in your brain. And that doesn't go over particularly well. So we have to be really gentle. And, after 23 years of doing this, I have a good sense of, you know, how the person is going to respond, and I know when to back off if I feel like I'm pushing too hard, but trying to plant the seeds that maybe this is out of touch with reality, which is what psychosis is all about.
Ray?
Yeah, I think in working with clients that you know, are in denial, not really functioning, I say, well, you know, what do you want out of life? Do you want to have friends? A lot of our clients get lost. Their classmates from high school, they go off to college. Oftentimes our clients don't go to college, they don't last long. And by the time they're in their early 20s, they've lost contact with all their friends, sometimes with the family members. So we really try to get them to have a little bit of insight to see, you know, maybe you need to, if you want to get a job, maybe if you take a little bit of medication, it can help you. If your thinking isn't as fast as you want it to be, maybe something like CET can help you to speed that up. And just to help folks understand that, you know, it doesn't mean, because you're thinking like this doesn't mean that's the way it has to always to be. And we all want to be like our friends and neighbors, and our clients do too.
Yes.
And I just want to jump in here. I think one of the features of the CET program is to take people back through some of the social developmental steps that they have missed out on. When you have an illness that just devastates you at the age of 17 to 25, typically, you have missed out on some of the things that we have learned just by trial and error as we've developed socially. And so folks who get stabilized on medication and have a stable place to live and are getting good treatment are still behind the eight ball in terms of interacting with other people in the community because they've missed out on a lot of that normal socialization that goes on, and they become desocialized. When they are talking about something that doesn't quite make sense, they get one of two typical reactions. Either people ignore them because they find them weird and they want to stay away from them, or they sort of, you know, kind of buy into it and say, ignore it, or they explain it away and they say something like, well, I think you meant to say this. Is that correct? Which just reinforces the whole desocialization process. And one of the big features of CET is that we take them back through that kind of development and challenge some of the things that they have been doing that the community has reinforced. So when they say something in group that doesn't quite make sense, we don't interpret it for them. We say something like, you know, I didn't quite get that. Could you explain it in a different way so that I could understand it? And through that process, combined with a lot of neurocognitive exercise, we find that they can, you know, kind of get over the hurdles that are present for them because of that whole process.
We did receive a call from a retired psychiatrist who wanted to remain anonymous, who said a presentation of symptoms depends on which part of the brain is affected, and asked Dr. Scale if you would expand on that.
Often in the frontal lobe, anything that's involving frontal lobe, we have, if you have cognitive dulling, flat affect, limited expression, monotone voice. We associate that with that part of the brain probably more. A lot of it depends. I mean, we don't really, again, know exactly what's going on in the brain with someone with schizophrenia. We know that people have heightened sensitivity to cues. So someone maybe in the visual cortex, maybe there's something going on. Why does someone see something that other person doesn't see? Why do you hear? Why does someone hear through the vents? You and I are hearing ear through the vents, where someone with schizophrenia might be hearing whispering coming through the vents. And is that somehow involved with the auditory part of the brain?
We also had a question from another listener who wants to know if you can develop schizophrenia later in life, in your 40s and up.
You can. It's not out of the question. It's not the norm, but yes, you can. And we don't know the etiology. Are there multiple reasons why someone gets schizophrenia? Much like we're thinking about Parkinson's now, that there's not one reason why you get schizophrenia. And some people that have can have drug-induced situations where they look for all purposes as if they have schizophrenia, even though it was a drug origin.
And then Kevin emailed.
Yes. Chime in.
Ray, go ahead.
Chime in here that the research is showing that chronic marijuana use for people in, the late teens, early 20s, where the brain is still forming. The brain really doesn't clearly form until you're like about 25, 28. In some cases, we think maybe it never does, the way some people act. But what we're seeing is that while it doesn't induce schizophrenia, if there is a likelihood, a genetic predisposition, it may bring it on sooner. So I would just urge people to be very careful about, smoking marijuana, especially with the high potency that's coming out now, until they're out of their early, late teens, early 20s, or at least not to do it on a chronic level. It can be, unfortunately, very dangerous for folks.
Kevin emailed and says, do you know the case of Yanni Schofield? I don't know anything about that. Does anybody?
Yes, no. Because I watch Discovery Health, so it speaks to Tracy's comments about developing schizophrenia when you're a child. I think she's six or so, and there's kind of an ongoing update of her progress. Yes.
If you have a question or a comment, our phone number is 513-419-7100. You can email us talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. We've talked a lot about the disease, haven't yet gotten into a lot of discussion about treatment. Let's go there next. What are some of the options if you have schizophrenia or you know someone that does? How do you treat the patient?
Well, medications are definitely an option. It's not the only option. And as a psychiatrist, I'm a trained psychopharmacologist. I do believe in medications for illnesses. And again, we actually call our patients, again, patients. I've been in the system a long time, and we've gone through client and consumer and things. And actually now, if you are someone seeing a psychiatrist, you are the patient of a psychiatrist, which is destigmatizing, because if you see your cardiologist, you are a patient of the cardiologist, not a client of the cardiologist, right? Mm-hmm. So we're trying to get back to this as a disease of the brain, illness of the brain. So medications are one option. Now, before 1950, there were really no options. And that's when people were in these asylums, and there'd be 2,000 people in asylums, and they would be running around and, insulin shock and cold water therapy and thing. Luckily, in 1950, Thorazine came out. That's how long that medicine's been out. There's still some people on it. I tend to not want to use the more traditional medications like that. That's also when lithium came out. But it did help people leave the asylums, and be treated more out in the communities. That was at the time that they believed that dopamine, or after that, we thought of the dopamine model, that if you have too much dopamine in your brain, that's why you have schizophrenia. And if we block your dopamine, then we'll block your voices and your delusions. There's something to that, but dopamine's all over the brain. So there's the mesocortical, mesolimbic, tuberoinfundibular system, all of this. So when you block it, it blocks all those things. So you can start getting decreased voices, but you might also have movement disorders. And by the way, to speak of why this is a brain illness, if you block dopamine and we decrease your voices, you might start getting some twitching of your arm or something. If your grandfather has Parkinson's disease, the neurologist might give your grandfather Cinemat or L-Dopa, which is a dopamine precursor. Grandpa might now have fewer movements, but he might start hearing voices. And it shows the fascinating how the brain works. The newer medicines are what we call atypical antipsychotics, meaning they still block dopamine, but they block serotonin more than they block dopamine. They're not without its issues. All of these medicines have their issues. It could be weight gain, metabolic issues like blood sugar spikes and cholesterol spikes.
Does those side effects cause people to not want to take their meds?
That's one of the reasons that people stop taking meds. They don't want to gain significant weight. They don't want movement. So the companies keep trying to invent a medication that has good efficacy yet lower side effect profile, and we're always looking for that. If someone is in treatment, I would encourage them to talk to their psychiatrist about whatever your illness is. Please talk to your doctor about what are things that could be a better medication for you if you're having side effects or problems. Some of the more traditional medicines caused cognitive dulling in and of themselves. So, and Stacy and Ray work with people with their cognitive issues. Sometimes is it the medication causing it, or is it the disease state itself?
Stacy, why don't you tell us some of the treatments that you're working with?
Well, I'm working really with one rehabilitative treatment at this point, and it's cognitive enhancement therapy, which is a cognitive rehabilitation program, a cognitive remediation program for people with basically, typically schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder. But we've been finding that CET works for people with severe bipolar disorder, people who are depressed, profoundly clinically depressed. And there was just a bit of research out of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center that said they're using it now for adults with autism spectrum disorders. And so it's starting to look like it can be applied at different places. It was originally developed for the population of people with schizophrenia, though. And again, it sort of addresses some of the things that medication can't. You need a complex approach to treat people. And if you can get a hold of the positive symptoms of the disease, you're still left with some of the negative symptoms, which cognitive enhancement therapy can address. The neurocognitive symptoms like poor memory and slow reaction time.
Well, what do you do? What is CET?
CET is a year-long program. I mean, we recruit people from the community to come in and take this class for an entire year. And it's a highly structured sort of class-like environment. So sometimes we don't even refer to it as therapy. We refer to it as kind of a pre-college level class for people who are a little bit scared to go in or thinking it's not for them kind of thing. So people come in for an hour, they pair up at the computer and they do neurocognitive exercises with a partner for an hour. Then we have a break, typically a half an hour kind of thing. And then we have what we call a social cognition group where we start with pretty low level material. Everybody, you know, a coach will introduce a topic like, one of the earlier topics is getting the gist of a situation. That's a social cognitive task. So a lot of people with schizophrenia either try to get the whole picture or maybe perseverate on a detail that's not very relevant to the situation or have forgotten how to communicate gistfully. And so that's an example of one of the social cognitive topics we go through. Somebody gives a discussion about it. The participants leave with homework that's to be completed. They meet with their coach between one CET session, group session, and the next to kind of personalize that experience to their lives. So a homework question might be, can you think of a time where you could not get the gist of a situation? And the coach will help that person kind of formulate some homework. And they come back in the next session, deliver their homework, answer some questions so that they can expand on their thinking and they can think in different ways. We challenge them to really think in those sessions. And then just like that old shampoo directions used to say, lather, rinse, repeat, we come in for another week, 52 weeks later, we have people who are thinking better, who can remember things, who can pay attention and aren't looking all around the room during the session, who remember what it's like to take another person's perspective because they've not had a lot of experience that because of the illness.
Ray, what about you? You also work with us?
Yes. I was lucky enough to be taught how to do CET by one of the co-developers of CET from the University of Pittsburgh, Sam Flesher. And Sam had a PhD in vocational counseling. So there's a lot of vocational components to CET. So as take an example that Stacy had about getting the gist. You know, it's like, you know, a good gistful statement is a movie review of King Kong. Big ape saves girl, but goes to New York City and has a bad end.
Yeah.
You could also write three pages, or actually probably whole dissertations on King Kong, but getting the gist of something very clear and crisp is really important. So if you're in a vocational situation and your boss gives you all these different directions, if you can boil it down to, well, I need to go and pick up those boxes of cell phones and bring them to Stacy's office, that's really what's the critical part of it. So we teach them a lot about getting those very vocationally oriented situations and help them to improve. And at the end, what we're really looking for is helping people become functional adults who are active, abstract thinkers, who can think on their own and not be on, like, automatic pilot. We all go through life. You all have situations where we get to work and say, how did I get here? You know, I don't remember anything from the time I left the home until I walked in the front door. But oftentimes, our clients go through whole days or weeks like that. And we really try to intervene and teach them to use their own brains.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. If you have a question or a comment, Kathy's calling from Springfield. Hi, Kathy. What's your question? Kathy?
Yes, hello? Yes.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a sister who had been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And she also had a lot of other random, but major depression and things like that. My question is, what might the relationship between borderline personality disorder and schizophrenia be?
Well, borderline personality disorder is a character pathology. It's not a psychotic disorder. However, people with true borderline personality disorder can fragment at times. They can lose touch with reality transiently. But that's not a key sign of borderline personality. It's more relationship-based. It's over-idealization and devaluation, frantic efforts to avoid abandonment, drastic changes in self-esteem, mood, that kind of thing. Typically, that's developmental. There's something. Often people with true borderline personality have had some kind of traumatic event earlier in life, often. But we tend to see that quite separate from schizophrenia.
We also have a question emailed in from Janet, who said her brother is 69. He was diagnosed in his teens and is now in a nursing home. Are there any clinical trials in Cincinnati he could participate in to see what is going on with his brain now?
And he does have a diagnosis of schizophrenia?
Apparently, yes. She just emailed.
I think the best source for looking at clinical trials would be to contact University Hospital to see what clinical trials are active right now, or Lindner Center of Hope, and see if anything's going on.
Marianne?
You can also contact the National Institutes of Mental Health. They have, if you go online and Google that, they have clinical trials. I think there's a web page just for that, and look to see where there is something that might be in Springfield, Ohio, maybe in Dayton, something like that. That would be some investigation that might happen. We've worked with people in CT in their early 60s and had some good responses. I think anything that you can do to help listener's brother to be cognitively active, to do things, to engage, to be socially active, talk to other people, play games, that sort of stuff is really important to do.
We're talking today about schizophrenia. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking about schizophrenia. Joining me are Chief Medical Officer for Greater Cincinnati Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Tracy Scale, Executive Director of Plan of Southwest Ohio, Dr. Stacy Martz, and Executive Director of the Center for Cognition and Recovery, Ray Gonzalez. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Marianne called in and wants to know how you can tell if someone is really ill or is just being antisocial. Is there an obvious line where actions point to a disorder?
Well, antisocial in the psychiatry world, there's actually a real diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder, which is more of conduct disorder, criminal type behavior, no remorse. So I'm thinking that you might mean asocial or not being very particularly social person. A lot will depend on how that person was before the illness. I mean, if they've always been social and now they're not, that might speak more to something more going on than just a personality thing. But typically there's more than just being withdrawn with schizophrenia. You'll see other kinds of symptoms. And it's often not just the negative symptoms. Typically people have these positive symptoms at some point, delusions or whatever. I actually have a question or a comment for Ray and Stacy about this. So what would you do in this situation for CET? So, in fact, we want to work very closely.
CET, we should say again, is cognitive Enhancement therapy.
Yep. Right. And actually, I'm so excited to be bringing, as I'm here today, I'm getting stimulated myself about how we can bring CET more and more into our agency because it's such an important option for our patients. So one of the things I've seen with my patients with schizophrenia, negative symptoms, is avolition. They don't have a lot of motivation to do things. Very frustrating for families because they think the person's lazy. It's really not that. It's just that they really can't get the motivation going. And here's an example. This one person really opened my eyes to this. We were having a conversation about hygiene, which is a difficult conversation. And his mother, who loves him dearly, sits in the appointment and said, it's just a little awkward, but he's my grown son, but he won't take showers. And that's, you know, uncomfortable. So I did some gentle processing and, you know, so tell me what's going on about showering, you know, what's that like for you? And he said this, and I'm a pretty fast talker, so I can't even slow myself down to talk as slowly as he talks. But he talks very slowly in a very monotone voice. And he said, well, you have to take off your clothes and then you have to turn on the water and then you have to use soap and then you have to rinse. And it was such an arduous process that he broke it down. It was an incredible eye-opener for me and his family. And at the end, I joked with him and said, wow, I don't want to take a shower either then because that sounds overwhelming. But it helped me understand what was going on. And it was such a huge process for him that for him, it was much easier to stay and also stay in my same clothes for days. I won't shower. So how would that be handled in a CET situation, do you think?
We've had that situation frequently. Somebody comes in and really a lot of times people come in and they're amotivated. I remember a young man who his initial treatment plan was, I have no interest in my future. And that's it's a little bit different level than what you're talking about, but amotivation is huge, that avolition. And what CET does is sort of ingenious in that we grab them and we do something fairly interesting and fairly doable up front. We do 5 weeks of just computer training. So they're on these neurocognitive exercises that really are designed for people who are post-stroke, and they have a lot of success with it, and they feel like they can do it. And then we gently get them into the social cognition group where they start realizing that other people have these issues as well, that they're not motivated. They don't want to take a shower. They don't have any interest in their lives. And it builds from there into more sophisticated topics, more abstract topics, less concrete. And most of the people who we get in that vein actually graduate from our program. In the Southwest Ohio program, we have an over 80% graduation rate, and our attendance rate every week from the groups that we've done since 2007 is also over 80%. So how it works, I'm not really sure, and maybe Ray can talk to this, but it does work. People are motivated to come to the groups because they find that they're thinking better, that they're thinking faster, that the motivation builds along the way.
Ray, you want to follow up with that?
Oh, I just wanted to follow up about Adam, the guy who had no interest in his future, is now employed by my organization to do some work with other consumers. He got so much motivation out of the program, graduated, and did a wonderful job. And he did it. It's really a great thing to see happen.
Right.
So he's Adam's now working, trying to get other folks to be motivated and reaching out to them.
You bet.
That's a great success story. What we find is by doing the computer exercises that we do and having a coach there, it's really important. What we call our therapists who do the work with CET are coaches. So it's much more of a coaching methodology where we do a challenge and support and work with folks rather than going back and being a psychotherapist and saying what the problems you had with your brother when you were, you know, 16 years of age, this is what happened. No, we don't deal with that. It's very educational. It's very much about how to learn how society functions and how the workplace functions. So doing the computer exercises, when someone can beat the computer game, they beat the computer game. They did it on their own. It's not something that I said, way to go, Stacy. You know, way to go, Marianne. Did a really great job there. They know that they won because they did it on their own. And we were always looking for the Goldilocks point, making the exercises not too easy, not too hard, just challenging enough to keep them engaged as they go along. And then once they get that, the brain begins to get a little more activated, that we really improve what's called processing speed, the ability to talk in a clear, coherent, and rapid fashion, like Dr. Scale, your client there, who was very slowed down and talking slowly about his bath. You know, we get them to come up to a normative level of functioning so they can talk about their bath and how overwhelmed they feel sometimes. And then we go through this whole series It's very curriculum-based. It's very structured. It's not real rigid, but structured. So we have people to give them additional challenges as they go along. And they learn about their brain. In fact, I think it's at least at a community college level, if not a psychology 101 brain or school course at the end of the year. They really got a lot of information about it.
All right, we're going to take a call now from Sam in Montgomery. Hi, Sam. What's your question?
Good afternoon, Marianne. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you.
My name is Sam, and I was prescribed a drug called Lucinta, which is an opiate painkiller, and that drug caused me to have hallucinations. I was taken to the emergency room, and I was admitted to the Christ Hospital psychiatric wing, diagnosed preliminarily with schizophrenia, and that was kind of haunted me for quite a while. It's been an issue with job applications. It's been quite a stigma. And I wish your guests could comment on those patients who exhibit some of the symptoms of schizophrenia and may not actually have that, and how that haunts them through their careers. If you don't mind, I'd love to take my answer off the phone.
All right, great, Sam. Thanks for calling, and we'll answer your question, I hope.
Yes, well, I'm sorry. That's a very unfortunate situation. I'm very sorry that that happened to you. It must have been really traumatic. Did they know that you – oh,
he
sorry, he's offline.
Yeah.
I'd be curious if people knew that you had just taken a medication, because that's really important information for someone in an emergency room if they say, oh, someone – this is what's new. They were on this medication, because medication side effects or adverse events can look like a psychotic disorder. So – I don't know the circumstances of your admission, but had you been with me, for example, and I had seen you, I think I would have said, I hope, I don't know what's going on with this person, but it's looking like psychosis. We would call it something like psychosis of unknown origin, or psychosis not otherwise specified, and not label schizophrenia at that point. And especially the fact that your symptoms remitted, and it sounds like probably off medications, you probably do not have the diagnosis of schizophrenia. And you're right. Once things are on a record, it's sometimes very difficult to take off of a record.
It's unfortunate, too, that there is such a stigma associated with schizophrenia and for this person's life. I mean, if he had taken a medication that caused a cardiac event and went to the emergency room, we would not even be talking to him on the phone today. It's a whole different ballgame. And I think, you know, the ability to come out and talk on the radio like we're doing today about something that's a biological illness is really useful for people. There's a huge weird double standard, and it is unfortunate that he got caught in that.
Well, I think sometimes people are afraid. Are schizophrenia what's the word? I'm not saying
people with
schizophrenia. Right, people with schizophrenia, are they dangerous to others, or really is it more an issue for themselves?
Mm, we could have a whole show about this, because so this is a very important topic, and it comes up in the news all the time. So unfortunately, we hear about people with schizophrenia when something violent occurs. And I've kind of changed my stance on this over the years. I used to think that, no, people with schizophrenia are absolutely no more violent than anyone else. In fact, they're much more likely to harm themselves, particularly in a situation they put themselves in vulnerable situations, et cetera. However, I've now changed over the years of practicing. I think that if you have untreated schizophrenia and you are paranoid you have command hallucinations that say things to you like, you know, push Dr. Martz off that chair or open the car door while the case manager is driving and different things like that, or you have an elaborate plan developed because of your delusional material, you can be more dangerous. So I've changed that a little bit, and I'm a little bit more on guard. But having the illness of schizophrenia in and of itself does not make you more dangerous. It just depends on what your symptoms are and how you react to them.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. Jacob's calling from Burlington. Hi, Jacob. What's your question?
Hi. I was wondering if there is a nutritional link to schizophrenia. I ask because when I was in college, I did a research project that talked about the link between a thiamine deficiency and a host of like learning disabilities. It caused some kind of disease based on that. I was wondering if there could be a possible link.
There certainly could be a possible link. And thiamine, I remember that very well in my residency. When someone would come in that was alcohol dependent, we always give them thiamine, because if you don't have that, you can lead to dementia and other cognitive illnesses. So certainly there could be a link. I know that CET, it talks about a holistic approach, Stacey and Ray, and we're all for that. I mean, medications are one option, but also a healthy diet, exercise, increased socialization, that's all important. I want to bring in one point for sure before we close, because I can see getting a lot of phone calls myself personally tomorrow from some of my own patients. I want to make sure people know that just negative symptoms are one thing, and they're particularly difficult to treat. There's not medications for that and all that, and it's harder to treat. But I have many people will say things like, well, I'm definitely not schizophrenic then, because I definitely shower every day. I'm clean and neat, and I'm very smart, and all these, and you can be brilliant and very well groomed and still have schizophrenia, particularly a paranoid schizophrenia. No one would even know you're schizophrenic until there's certain key things that might be your particular delusion.
Thanks so much for your call, Jacob. We appreciate it. Again, our number 513-419-7100. Ben's calling from Westchester. Hi, Ben. What's your question?
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I kind of have two things, actually. The first one regarding desocialization you guys were talking about. Are there any tips you can give to someone who doesn't really know how to communicate in a conversation? Basically, I have a very, very hard time trying to talk with other people. I very rarely even socialize myself. I have ADD. I also have adjustment disorder due to anxiety. But I find that for the past 4 or 5 years, I've never really socialized with anybody outside of my family who I stay with. I was just curious if you'd give me anything about that.
Ray, do you want to start with that one?
I think what I would suggest would be if you would, the more times, more opportunities you give for yourself, the better that you'll be able to develop this skill. And maybe doing some volunteer work, something that people really like the fact that you show up and to do the work, and you have to, don't feel that you have to talk all the time. Just, you know, when you feel right, you know, get into the flow of things and just, you know, have a couple things you do want to talk about, that you may have some ideas or some information in your own head about, you know, talk about Cincinnati Reds or you know, what's a great movie you just saw, whatever. So you have some topics to do about and just try and engage folks. And, you know, we all make mistakes. We all make faux pas. It's not the end of the world, and no one's going to, you know, go screaming from the room if you don't say things in the right order. That's fine. And just the more opportunities, the more practice you have, the more skill you'll develop.
I completely agree, Ray. I mean, practice is so underrated. And what CET does is have people practice in a structured environment. I mean, when I'm out selling CET, I always say, you know, it's not the case that somebody goes out and hits a baseball bat or baseball perfectly. They have to practice to do it. And socialization is the same way. You have to put in some practice.
Ben, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Burke's calling from Wyoming. Hi, Burke. What's your question?
Well, my question is, I came in somewhat towards the end of your program, and I have a colleague whose son is schizophrenic, but have had tremendous difficulty over the years getting him to take his meds, and there just does not seem to be programs that, and I use the word halfway house, which is not really the correct word, but something that is an affordable program where, you know, maybe it's like assisted living or something that these people can go into, because it absolutely destroys the families.
Thoughts what they can do
for the
son that won't take meds.
We work with people that don't take medications, and we have all kinds of options available. If he would agree to engage with us and he has Medicaid or some kind of insurance, he could actually show up on our doorstep at GCB, and we'll be happy to try to help him and the family.
Yeah. The other thing I want to do is encourage folks to join NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. Lots of great support there of other families who've gone through things like your colleagues, head with his son and stuff, and then get lots of support and ideas to help people recover.
Burke, thanks so much for your call. We are just about out of time. We appreciate it. One quick question. Mary emailed, can you provide any information in about 20 seconds here on whether Medicaid covers mental illness treatments?
Medicaid does cover mental illness treatments, yes.
That's a simple answer. All right. Well, thank you all very much for being here. We certainly appreciate it. And thanks for joining us. We've been talking today about schizophrenia. My guests have been Chief Medical Officer for Greater Cincinnati Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Tracy Scale, Executive Director of Plan of Southwest Ohio, Dr. Stacy Martz, and Executive Director of the Center for Cognition and Recovery, Ray Gonzalez. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Rick Andres. We also had help today from Kevin Reynolds. Our engineering staff is Don Danko, Bill Dean, and Mike Makinich. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik.